Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. In the past decade, many commentators have increasingly spoken of growing competition between the United States and China, in areas like trade, industrial policy, but also in areas like foreign policy and global influence more generally. To talk about these issues and on how the social sciences can learn from evolutionary thinking, in January 2025, I spoke to Shiping Tang, Fudan Distinguished Professor and Dr. Sika Chan Chair Professor at Fudan University. He is also Cheng Kong, Distinguished Professor in the Chinese Ministry of Education. Our conversation ranged over how Professor Tang's early career as a biologist has informed his thinking about social science issues, how democracies promote growth, and whether we should talk about the US and China being in competition at all. Well, thanks so much for joining us here on The Ballpark today. Could you start by briefly introducing yourself and your research for our listeners? Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here, to be part of this podcast. I'm from Fudan University in Shanghai. My name is Shiping Tang. I studied as a natural scientist. Mostly I spend my time studying biology, and then I turned to social science. I'm doing quite a few different things at the same time, usually. I started as a more like an international relations scholar, and then I kind of ventured out to the economic development, compared politics, a little bit philosophy of social science. I'm also running a small center, and we actually do a little bit computational social science too.
So as you've said, you began your career as a biologist and have since turned to the social sciences. How has your earlier work in the sciences informed your thinking on international politics, trade, and development?
It's actually not easy to tell, you know, what kind of things I draw from my earlier training. But I can, I think, name maybe two or three things. One is, I think, understanding natural science, and including part of the philosophy of natural science, I think is useful for us to understand social science, including some of the, you know, methodological debate. So for instance, when I first read the, you know, King, Cohen, and Verba's KKV, like designing social inquiry in 97, 98, so I was a little bit surprised they actually had a such, I would say, at least incomplete, if not incorrect, view about natural science. So they only had, you know, the random trial experiment as one particular experiment. But that's only one kind of experiment we actually do in natural science. So that's one thing. The second, I think, is really partially because I study paleontology and modern molecular biology. So I always had the sense of time and space because evolution is really about things operating across time and space. So Darwin was a universal theorist in the sense that he created a theory that allowed us to theorize how, you know, biological species, you know, evolved across time and space. So I actually some of the things I have been working on about philosophy of social science, really how can we integrate time and space into our understanding about the evolution of social system, but also, you know, how our individual evolve socio-psychologically. So you can tell, you know, the evolutionarism has impacted my research quite a bit. And the final thing I like to think is, it's really because I grew up in a very small village and, you know, very poor, isolated small village. So I think I have firsthand, of course, experience about, you know, poverty and how you can achieve some degree of economic development. But I know it's really difficult. And therefore, I think I bring the study of economic development, some first-hand experience. I was also like a local official for like a year or so. It's not a very high-ranking one. But, you know, I got to know the nitty-gritty of, you know, doing things on the ground. So unlike, say, I don't want to use a bad word, say, armchair professor. So I had some... I also worked in two biotech companies, so I know some how things done or were run on the ground. Okay.
So you've been described as one of the few modern-day international relations academics to construct a grand theory in the form of the social evolutionary paradigm. For listeners who might be unfamiliar with your work, could you talk a bit about what the social evolution paradigm is?
Okay, so I would call the social evolution paradigm as the ultimate paradigm, in the sense the Darwin theory was, you know, quote unquote, the universal asset for understanding how biological evolution operates, not only on this particular planet, but also if anywhere in the universe, the evolution of biological species will still obey the central rules or central mechanism of variation, selection, and inheritance. So in a way, social evolution paradigm is it's like a modification of the biological evolutionism, and then try to apply it to the understanding of human society, right? And of course, human society is very different from biological system. The most critical one is actually we invented ideas. Therefore, we had language, and we can invent ideas. And most equally important, I would say, we use our ideas to create artificial system, including, say, universities, ballparks, those kind of stuff, right? But we also change our physical environment around us. For instance, the advancement of science and technology allows us to conquer different territories or terrain, and therefore we will be able to modify the surrounding physical environment around us. So to name three things, what distinguish social science, social evolution paradigm from, let's say, biological evolutionism since Darwin. The first is really, as I said, human society is very different from a biological system, most critically because we have ideas, and therefore the ideational forces brings entirely different dimension to social evolution. And therefore, part of the social evolution paradigm has to bring together material forces and ideational forces. Right? So the second very important point to be taking home is really, even though these two systems are very different, but they also have some commonalities, partially because human society was built by a biological species called Homo sapiens, right? So therefore, we actually came, we were a product of biological evolution, and therefore we cannot escape that from that. And so our, even though we invented ideas, our evolution, our social evolution is also partially underpinned by biological evolution. Therefore, the evolution of social system is also constrained by our biological evolution. So, and this is why you have to modify some of the mechanism or rules from biological evolution to social evolution. So for instance, in social evolution, you can have selection before variation, whereas in biological evolution, you can only have variation subject to natural selection. So that's another key difference. The final one is really in social evolution, things are far more complex because humans have agency. And therefore, it's very difficult to have a universal theory, I would put that way. So you cannot really have a universal theory. So I'm call me like a modern day grand theorist, but I don't really aim to develop a universal theory. I develop specific theory for certain domains. And some of those domains can actually have a more general theory. But any general theory in social science will not become a Darwinian theories, which is applicable to all the biological species.
You first presented the social evolution paradigm in 2013, I believe. How has the theory developed since then, and how does it continue to inform current thinking on international relations?
It's not easy to convince social scientists to embrace evolutionism, partially because there are quite a few misunderstandings about evolutionism. For instance, most people, when they hear about evolutionism, instantly the first term is social Darwinism, which is a misnomer. The term social Darwinism should be more appropriately labeled as a social Spencerism. Herbert Spencer was a far more influential intellectual in the 19th century in Britain, but also in the English-speaking world. Another very popular misconception, misunderstanding was, evolution means the survival of the fittest, all right? That is entirely wrong, because a biological evolution does not reproduce, quote unquote, fittest trait or fittest species. It only produces fitter in relative terms across in different niches or different environments. So a lot of social scientists, they have some misconception about evolutionism. That's first. Second is, I think it's evolutionism, most people believe it's more useful for the long run kind of evolution thing, because usually evolution operates in fairly longer time frame. And therefore, I'm not really saying you should apply evolutionism to everything you want to understand. But what I'm saying is, if you want to understand the transformation of international system or social system, but also the psychological speaking. So a typical a masterpiece would be, Norbert Elias, The Civilization Process, which was a truly exemplary application of social evolution paradigm, although he didn't really use the term. So this is the second point I'd like to highlight. I myself have been applying social evolution paradigm to some of the things I write. For instance, I think human psychology or political psychology has a deep social evolutionary root rather than just a purely biological one. So therefore, why we had a certain appetite for, honor, prestige, that's very social rather than purely biological. I hope, some other scholars can pick up some of the elements, but, it's beyond my control. I think it's gaining some followers, but I hope it could be more.
In a recent event here at LSE with Iraqi politician and scholar Ali Elawi, you discussed that the successes of 21st century development are tied to US-China competition. What does this competition look like, and why has it been a success in terms of development?
I think I singled out three things which puts the nature of this particular U.S.-China rivalry or competition as fairly unique or unlike any other previous great power rivalries we had come to know, right? The first is, even though maybe today the West does not really count Russia as part of the West, but for the last five centuries, let's say since 1500 AD, all the great powers in the modern state system came from the West. So China is not a part of the West, however you want to classify the West. So this, I think, is the very first time that, a non-Western power became a very important economic power. And that's entirely unprecedented, partially because, not only because all previous great powers were in the West, but also, let's say, the Soviet Union during its Cold War years had never reached more than half of the total GDP of the United States. And if you count Germany, West Germany, and Japan during the Cold War years, they were U.S. allies. Even their size is actually comparatively smaller than, let's say, China's economy relative to the U.S. size. So I'm not really entirely convinced about the PPP calculation, but I think the size of economy of the Chinese economy is somewhere between the nominal U.S. dollar and the PPP calculation. So China's economy its size has reached a certain portion of the United States economy. And this partially explains why the U.S. fear and anxiety and certainly some resentment against China's growth. Right? So that's a very first important element about this particular rivalry. The second is really Russia or USSR was never a very important economic player in the world system. But China, whether you want to put it like a state-centric capitalism or Chinese capitalism, socialism, with Chinese characteristics, it's a global economy, a globalized economy with a very strong market-driven dynamics. Also, very importantly, China in some key technologies is catching up rapidly. And in some areas, you can argue, actually, China is actually ahead in terms of publishing groundbreaking papers or even some new technologies. So that has never really happened before, right? So the only exception was the United States took over Great Britain in the late 19th century, around 1895 or something. Then I'd like to highlight why this particular rivalry can be the can benefit developing countries, because partially because of those two things. So China is in a position to provide capital, technology, and even training of human capital to developing countries, which the Soviet Union was never able to do other than supplying weapons and maybe some fuels. So and a very important element of this particular dynamics is also, I would argue, after 1945, you know, the end of the Second World War, a lot of developing countries were beginning to gain their independence, and therefore they have to, their foremost task was to build a state. As I argue in my recent book, state capacity is the more foundational one within the, what I call the new developmental triangle. So you need a decent level of state capacity in order to able to support or underpin economic development. And I would argue, some of my friends or colleagues from developing country may not really agree or like what I say, but I would argue after 50 years, 75 years, let's say from 1945 to today, developing countries, many developing countries were able to achieve or accumulate certain level of state capacity, and therefore they were in more versatile or robust position to support the economic development, including you need, actually, I would argue, in for most different countries, you need some economic planning in order to develop. I don't think developing countries can really repeat with the Britain or, you know, so-called free market economy to really achieve sustainable economic development. So those are the three elements I like to highlight, saying, you know, why this particular U.S.-China rivalry may be actually good for developing countries, partially because though the three main things I highlight.
So you've touched on this, just talking about benefits to developing countries. Would you say that they have been the biggest winners in U.S.-China competition? I'd also be interested to know who you think the biggest losers have been in U.S.-China competition, and if you have any suggestions that would correct any of the inequalities that have resulted from this sort of relationship.
Before I name any name of countries or, you know, political entities, whatever, or economic entities, I would like to emphasize only a country or a state or economic entity can actually achieve its own economic development if it tries. So there is no free lunch in economic development. You cannot really, I'm not really arguing, say, as long as you have U.S.-China economic rivalry, you will have economic development in the global south. That's entirely untrue. So you need developing countries to try to achieve economic development by themselves. So let me use the example of East Asian Development State, which I think China is a variant of that particular development model. Those countries still had to try to achieve economic development, even though there was U.S. Versus Soviet Union Cold War, and therefore it was beneficial to countries like Japan, South Korea, Singapore, etc. So today, you still need to do the same thing. So country with a stronger state capacity, with a decent institutional foundation, and know how to do certain economic planning, they will be able to benefit more from this particular competition. I don't want to offend anybody, but I would argue, say, a country like Vietnam or maybe Indonesia, they are very successful so far in terms of, be able to, I'm not using this term in any bad sense, play the United States versus China against each other, but they were very adept in terms of getting the U.S. to agree to certain terms and getting the Chinese to other certain terms, and therefore they'll be able to benefit from both sides. The biggest losers, I would argue countries tend to, if they go to one side entirely, they may actually be in danger of losing a lot of things, because when you are siding with one side too closely, maybe the other side will not be able to offer anything useful or beneficial. Because usually when a country sided with one side too closely, the other side will resent that kind of arrangement. So I would argue most countries will be, most developing countries at least, will be able to benefit more by staying more or less equal distance between US and China. And but this is not only consideration for the country to consider when they choose their policies in terms of foreign policy, but also economic policies.
So I think a lot of people listening might think of the idea of competition between anything is two different parties or rivals kind of working in opposition to achieve maybe the same goal or different goals. Thinking about the US-China relationship, so the US has imported hundreds of billions worth of goods from China. I think it's its largest source of imports. China is also, I think, in the top five of US export partners. There's a lot of trade going on between the two countries. They're actually quite interrelated, really. There's a very close connection in some ways. Is competition the right way to describe the US's relationship with China and China's relationship with the US?
I think it is certainly misleading to say there's only competition. That's, of course, entirely wrong. So you can have US, China, and trade with each other quite extensively. And I would argue there used to be really extensive technological and science research collaboration too, which I think is really good for not just for the two countries, but really for the human society as a whole. But the competition, I really think it's now the dominant, if not the most important part of the motivation or driver in shaping how the two countries calculate about their relationship. I think it really started around, 2010, when the United States started pivot to Asia. Although there was no explicit say that was really targeting China, but most people really understand that was really against China. So before that, I don't think the two countries really think in a very competitive way. But after 15 years of those things, I don't think really we can say, well, there is no competition. I don't think that's really a realistic way of seeing these two countries. And I would also argue some sense of competition may be actually useful for the two countries, but also for some, as I said in the previous question, maybe for developing countries too. And in a way, I think competition also drives innovation in both two countries, and which I think, recent AI race, sixth generation fighters race, these are really driven by great power competition. I do want to end this particular question with a more hopeful note. So I think that there is more ground for optimism. It's partially because these two countries really trade with each other really extensively. Let's say unlike the Soviet Union versus the US, right? So, and secondly, is really the two countries know each other much better than, let's say, the Soviet Union and the US were able to achieve, partially because a lot of Chinese students study in the US and then go back, and used to quite a lot of American students study in China too. So I think the two countries know each other better, although I would argue this may be my one-sided impression. But I think the US public and the US politicians, they are more ideological than what Chinese public and also Chinese politicians. So they tend to miss some of the subtle or nuanced things going on within China, right? So therefore, for instance, some of the, let's say, the typical Acemoglu, Robinson, Jameson, the AJR people, they would say, well, without democracy, you cannot really innovate. And China is autocracy, so China is really trying to extract predatory kind of those stuff. That's entirely misleading, I think. China, of course, any state has to extract. Otherwise, it cannot invest in all those infrastructure, not just physical infrastructure, but also infrastructure such as libraries, schools, universities, those kind of stuff. So I would argue, I think being too ideological is really not helpful for understanding how these two countries compete. And also, it's bad for those two countries themselves to make policies.
So over the past decade, US and Chinese foreign policies have followed quite distinct trajectories. How would you describe their key differences?
I think we can do a very long list, but I think there were three things really I think should be fairly apparent or obvious to any observer of those two countries' behavior. First is, you know, the US keep fighting wars, which I think Donald Trump was correct to realize that. I think it's bad for U.S. society. And I think Peter's more recent book, Geopolitics and Democracy, also highlights some of the potential danger of, you know, fighting too many wars and therefore undermines, actually, U.S. democracy within the United States. So that's a very typical trajectory of a difference in terms of their foreign policy. The second, I think, is certainly the Chinese foreign policy are more like inward looking, has always been so. And I think, you know, no matter how you want to portray the current Chinese foreign policy, China is more, you know, internally orientated. Because it's a developing country, unlike the United States, which is, you know, still the most powerful countries. And therefore, it thinks that, you know, domestic politics is relatively inconsequential. But for China, the most important task has always been to become a more developed country. So therefore, foreign policy for China, I think, remains subservient to its domestic agenda, which I think in the US, you may not be able to argue the same thing. The third is really, I think, China's foreign policy is not really mostly driven by military objectives, partially because we don't want to fight wars. Even, you know, we don't even want to fight in order to reunify with Taiwan. I think, you know, I mean, it's a misperception. Say, you know, China would just want to go with force and try to occupy and retake Taiwan. Military supremacy has not been an objective for the Chinese foreign policy. All we need is actually to defend our territorial integrity, et cetera, et cetera. So China's foreign policy, I think, is more driven by economic consideration rather than security consideration. So those are the three things, and the major big things, because the three big things can be, you know, expanded to include a host long list of other minor differences, but I think those three things are the most important ones.
So in your 2022 book, The Institutional Foundation of Economic Development, you create a framework for analyzing how institutions affect growth. Could you just explain to our listeners a bit about how this framework operates? Thank you.
As I just mentioned, you know, I was born, I grew up in a very small, tiny, and poor village in southern part of Hunan. Our village only had like 15 households. That was it. So I think I experienced poverty, but I also experienced the transformation of Chinese economy because I used to work and study for about from 1981 to 1990, so there was like 9 years before I went to the United States to study for my PhD and then MA degree in social science. So I would argue, I didn't really begin to think about economic development seriously until 2002 or something. I was posted as like a local, middle-level local official in one of the poorest and underdeveloped region of China. It's called the Ningxia Hui Autonomous Region. And that 1 year, I think, in a way, shaped my career trajectory, but also my intellectual orientation. So it took me like 20 years to get this particular book done because I was not retrained as an economist anyway. But, you know, that has its advantage in a way that I can draw from different fields. I provide this background so that I can elaborate more about this particular framework, because the question drove my thinking is really, how can a country encourage its population or its people to contribute to economic development productively rather than say unproductively. You can, let's say you can, you know, become rich by robbing a bank. You can also try to become rich by working hard in the field or in the factory. And those two things are very different. And therefore, so my starting question was saying, actually one of the metaphor by Olson in 1996, he had a paper titled Big Bills on the Sidewalk. So if you, I'm not going to get into the details of the metaphor, but anyway, so I started with that metaphor and partially because I think my training in natural science, I put that way. So we always want to search for the answer at the end of the logic deduction, right? So if you push that metaphor really rigorously enough, you will come up with what I call the pickle. So possibility, incentive, capability, and opportunity, right? So if you have those four things, possibility, incentive, capability, and opportunity, and then you will more or less arrive some of the six major dimensions, what I call the institutional foundation of economic development. I'm not going to get into the detail. The final point I want to add is institutions are important, but it's not the only thing for underpinning economic development. You still need what I call the new developmental triangle, which the state capacity is more foundational because you need the state capacity to make rules, enforce rules. Otherwise, you can have all those kind of constitution or charter, you know, nobody really pay much attention. And also you need adaptive policies, including social, political policies, but also, you know, most economists will be more interested in industrial policy or macroeconomic policy. So you need those three things together. And this is why sustained economic development is so difficult. It's so rare. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, the whole world has not really developed. So I encourage anybody who wants to understand the difficulties and challenges, but also the opportunities of achieving economic development, to take a look at my book. I can assure you, I think my book is better than Why Nations Fail.
You've argued that democracy's protection of liberty provides a subtle advantage in promoting growth compared to the stability of autocracy. What makes this advantage subtle and what can damage it? Are there any instances where an autocratic country's stability has an advantage over democratic growth?
This part of the theory is actually one or two chapters in my book. So I cannot really get into too much detail about the book. We actually provide a historical case study, but also cross-national growth regressions. As a natural scientist, I like to combine qualitative or case study evidence, but also quantitative evidence, partially because those two methods kind of complement each other rather than say, you know, they are against each other. So the subtlety is really, I can put it in a very one sentence, right? So the advantage or the utilities of democracy in sustaining economic development is indirect, it's channel specific, and also conditional. So I would argue much of the existing cross-country regression, including by AC Mugru themselves, to regress democracy score or regime score with economic growth or economic growth rate, those results are not really very convincing. They are not really robust at all. So the reason is because, as I highlighted just a short while ago, the advantage of democracy in promoting economic growth is indirect, channel-specific, and conditional. So the key is, I think, well, in a way, democracy is a political system provides protecting liberty. In doing innovation, sometimes you have to go against the reigning, you know, orthodoxy, whatever. You know, a typical example will be Galileo was punished by the Roman Catholic Church because he was going against the orthodoxy promoted by the church. Right? So, you know, the earth stands at the center of the universe rather than the sun. So you can have innovation under autocracy. I'm not saying under the autocracy you cannot really have innovation. What I argue is if the innovation is so challenging to the orthodoxy, an autocracy may actually want to kill it. And therefore, you need democracy at the frontier of innovation. And it's actually not my original insight. You know, Karl Popper, Hayek, they all said it. It's just, you know, before my theory, I would say most There was no really rigorous theorization of this particular insight by Karl Popper and Hayek. So I'm arguing autocracy can have innovation, but in autocracy, you usually have more top-down rather than bottom-up. And this is one of the advantages of democracy comes in. The key is, of course, to balance bottom-up and top-down innovation. So if you only have top-down innovation, you may actually stamp bottom-up innovation and therefore can damage the potential for innovative growth. And I think in today's China, because China is now getting closer and closer to the technological frontier, so some liberalization will be useful, I think, for sustaining China's economic growth in the next decade or maybe two.
So we're now about a week on from Donald Trump's inauguration for the second term as President of the United States. What can we expect from the U.S. government in the coming months and the next 4 years, really, in terms of China and the international system more widely? Given the fact that Donald Trump only has one term left, 4 years, is there any potential for sustainable and productive growth in those relationships?
Okay, so I would like to do a little bit of promotion. So we actually forecast his election. Actually, we also predict that he would actually have won by competing with Joe Biden in June of 2024. So our computational social science can actually allow us to forecast, you know, the U.S. elections. I think our forecasting was the most accurate one, at least public available ones. So we actually predicted or forecasted he was going to win at least five of those swinging states. So we missed the other three. And the key why he was able to win, I think, was more or less driven by domestic issues rather than international ones. And I think he was right to recognize that. So I think the MAGA is really a movement for domestic revolution, not violently, but MAGA, at least under Trump's second term, he really wanted to remake the American state, you know, say, you know, deep state is enemy or whatever. That's a very difficult task, I would put that way. So to engineer a domestic revolution without violence, certainly violence is bad, but it's not easy, actually, and quite rare. So I don't know whether he will be able to succeed or not. So I think most observers will be able to have a better forecast than what I can do. Now, in terms of its foreign policy, I would argue Biden actually was more hawkish than Trump's first term, I would put that way. So at least against China. But, you know, the world, according to social evolution pattern, has already moved on. So today's international system or international environment is different from, let's say, when Trump first came to power in 2016. I think there is a lot of uncertainty what he wants to do, and also, you know, the kind of reaction from not just from China, but also from other countries, including UK, EU, Russia, India, so on and so forth. But I would argue his foreign policy is now going to serve his domestic agenda. So it actually makes the United States today somewhat similar to China's agenda. It means you have to fix your own house first before you do anything abroad. But I don't know whether Trump in his second term will be able to really follow up what he or his government had in mind. About U.S.-China relation itself, I would hope or, you know, think there is a chance maybe the two countries can reach a certain deal. We don't know the exact form of the deal, but the reason why I'm slightly more hopeful, I think, is this. It's, I think, both sides now realize it's really about the U.S. side, right? So I think China underestimated, let's say when Trump came to power in the first term, China underestimated the fury of Trump's foreign policy and Biden's continuation of Trump's foreign policy. But I also think that the United States underestimated the resilience of China's economy. I'm not saying China's economy is doing well, it faces a tremendous amount of challenges, but certainly it's not really you know, as bad as most people like to portray it or think or hope. So I think once the two countries, I don't know how close we are there to that. If the two countries can realize that, you know, you cannot really defeat me easily and I cannot really defeat you easily. You know, China has no intention to really dethrone the U.S. primacy. You know, China would just want to say, you know, you respect my interests, I respect yours, and you don't have to, you know, try to constantly try to put me down. So if the two countries can realize that an outright victory by either side is not a very easy possibility, maybe they will be able to achieve some kind of deal. But I don't know the exact time frame or the, you know, the shape of the deal. I think it's going to take a lot of hard bargaining.
And then just finally, I'd just like to give you the opportunity to point our listeners towards any new books, articles, or any resources you think they would find useful and interesting.
I certainly hope that, you know, anybody who is from a developing country should take a look at my 2022 book, The Institutional Foundation of Economic Development. I think it's a really a good book, a very important book, and I think it provides useful lessons for developing countries to do so. For more scholarly stuff, you know, you can just Google my scholarly website, whatever, and I'm working on two projects. I like to work on several projects at the same time. One is hopefully I will be able to finish by the end of this year. It's really the social psychology of international conflict and cooperation. The main title is From Fear to Trust, which I hope will be able to provide some of the micro or psychological foundation for understanding international conflict and cooperation, including the U.S.-China relationship. That's one project I'm working on. The second project I'm also working on probably will take, you know, another 1 or maybe 1.5 years. It's really to provide a more grand scheme for understanding human society. So it connects with my social evolution paradigm, and I'm developing some of the key toolbox for applying social evolution paradigm for the understanding of human society.
Listeners should look out for those upcoming resources, and we'll be linking to the other resources we've talked about in this conversation in our show notes. Just remains me to say, Professor Shiping Tang, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thank you so much, Chris. Great to be to have this conversation.
Shiping Tang is Fudan Distinguished Professor and Dr. Sika Chan Chair Professor at Fudan University, as well as a Cheung Kong Distinguished Professor in the Chinese Ministry of Education. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Shiping Tang for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Luke Digweed. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @lse_us. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people to find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.